Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits show, and I am your host, Miko Bits, and today I have an exciting show. I have the Brightmans, Kathleen and Arthur Brightman, who created Tezos, which is of course a very novel layer one, and there's some very exciting news that they're going to share. So before we get in, this video is information and entertainment purposes, so it's not intended to be investment advice, so please seek a duly licensed professional for that. Before we start, if you're interested in Bitcoin and blockchain, please consider clicking that subscribe button. And also click the bell so you can get notifications about future videos that I might post. Thank you. Okay, without further ado, hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes, excellent. It's wonderful having you here. I think the first question that I usually ask is, just the origin story, particularly around this whole blockchain phenomenon, like how did you get into it, and then obviously we can go anywhere from there.
Sure. Yeah. So I think my interest, like almost everyone in this space, started with Bitcoin, and I heard very early on about Bitcoin, but I didn't pay attention to it very early on. Kind of like set it into a folder and says like, oh, I should look into that, and I didn't really start getting interested in like really to Bitcoin until 2011, 2012. Where I started playing with it and learning about it. And what immediately attracted me was all of the research which was going on for improving different aspects, in particular in terms of consensus and in terms of privacy. And I remember when the Zero Cash paper came out, and I'm not talking about Zcash currency, I'm talking about the Zero Cash paper. And I was like, this is fantastic, because one of the biggest problems in Bitcoin is the lack of privacy. And finally, there can be privacy in Bitcoin. That's so huge. And then I realized that there was actually very little interest in the Bitcoin community in implementing the technology. And I remember basically hearing for a long time, all the altcoins, they may be innovating, but Bitcoin is just a ledger. It can always take the best innovation. And that speech, more from that to, oh, no innovation outside of Bitcoin is worthwhile anyway, and so we're better off staying where we are, which sounds a lot like sour grapes. So I really started thinking, because there was an idea in the Bitcoin ethos, which is very important, of like, no, we don't want to willy-nilly change the protocol. It has, you have to have some guarantees that the protocol is not going to change. But on the other hand, you also want to have some flexibility to take into account innovation. So how can you reconcile both things? How can you have inflexible rules, but the possibility of evolution? And that's the main idea behind Tezos. You have very strict rules around how, when, why the protocol can change.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my origin story is much more simple. It's that, Arthur and I got married in 2013, and for most of our courtship and subsequent marriage, all he would talk about is Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. And so I had an if you can't beat them, join them moment. Thankfully I found this stuff a lot more interesting than I thought I would. It's been a fun, been a fun career change in some ways. But a lot of what Arthur likes talking about is culminates in cryptocurrencies. He likes finance, he likes economics, he likes computer science, and all of the, fun parts of the vanguard in those respective fields. And you'd have to be foolish not to think, not to look at the cryptocurrency space and not say like, oh my goodness, this is tailor-made for Arthur's, various interests. And so I kind of knew when he started talking about it that I was going to hear about it for a lot longer. I say I married into it.
That's great. I was very excited at the time in reading about it, because for me, we had all had the experience of looking at Litecoin, right? And, in essence, if you look at Litecoin, it's very much along the lines of some of what you were describing, right? Which is, in some ways, it kind of, is a kind of a testnet type of a thing, right? For Bitcoin, which is not even like focused on programmability, right? So it's sort of the idea of like anything you can do, we can do better is really about kind of the jewel that is open source, right? But I think that the thing that's really novel that I really appreciated about what you're bringing is this idea of self-amendment, right? Which is sort of this evolutionary governance construct, right? So to me, that's a really interesting point, because the thing that's so interesting about governance is that governance is very hard to fork, you know, because it involves culture and it involves kind of like how the interaction between kind of the mechanism and the community. So I think in some ways, the existence of such a mechanism predisposes the emergence of a certain kind of a community. So I don't know if you guys have seen that, but like it feels that's kind of how it feels like it would go.
Yeah, I think you have to look at it as a coordination mechanism. The problem with fork-based governance, and fork-based governance, by the way, predates cryptocurrency. It's the type of governance you have in most open source projects. In an open source project, when you have different teams who have a different vision on how they're going to move the software, they can, you know, make a copy of the code and implement two different versions. And then you can use one or you can use the other one as a user. You have a choice. That may work for software. It doesn't really work for money, because the whole point of money is it relies completely on network effect, right? You want your money to be accepted by other people. They have to be using the same money. So you cannot fork. Like if you fork, either you're going to like spread the value, or you're going to have one fork which is going to be worse, less, and one fork which is going to capture the value. The question is like, what determines the winner in a fork? And what I argue is that the winner is not really defined by merit necessarily. It's going to be defined by social expectations. And having a form of full governance kind of beats that. It's the idea that it's not social expectations, but actually what people think of the merit of the fork, which is going to determine whether or not a change can be approved.
The other thing that I thought was particularly novel too was really starting to think about things like distribution and thinking about like how development gets funded, right? So I think some of those innovations are so interesting, right? Because to me, the thing that's fascinating about what Satoshi brought with Bitcoin is this kind of notion that you could fund like ops. Right. So you could create like a previously impossible, because humans can give up their time freely because they have free will. Right. But machines don't really give up electricity freely because of just that's a business concern and it becomes, you know, an expense. Right. So obviously the idea that running a node can of this open source can actually generate money for you that kind of effectively compensates you for doing it, like creating almost like an open source ops. But I think the thing that Satoshi largely left as an exercise was this idea that people could be you know, that the project funding could be related, right? Because the reason why I say it was a thought exercise is because if you look at Bitcoin Core, the variability of compensation within Bitcoin Core was like just all over the place, right? There are really original developers that have very few Bitcoins, and then there are some that have many. And in a way, it was largely gated on the factor of whether they decided to mine early or not, which is not correlated with the scale of their contribution, right? So I guess I'm curious about how you see that.
Well, I mean, the financing mechanism in Bitcoin is basically the same as many open source projects, which is that they rely on wealthy patrons, essentially. Like, there's a lot of wealthy people who hold Bitcoin or wealthy people who like Bitcoin, and who basically are willing to pay developers to maintain it. So, you know, even though you may have a free rider problem, there are people who are wealthy enough and the amounts are small enough for them that they don't mind doing it. That's one method of funding. I think the insight is that if you look at cryptocurrencies, the first thing you think about is separate property, right? You have your coins, I have my coin. And so you might think like, well, when you have very, very clear property rights and very well delineated rights, you don't really need governance, because you know you do your own thing with your own coin. I do my own thing with my own coin. You need governance when you have common parts. So let's say we live in an apartment building. You know, you can do whatever you want in your apartment. I can do whatever I want in my apartment. But if the elevator breaks down, you know, we have to have some governance to decide like who's going to pay for the repair, how we're going to pay for the repair, and so on and so forth, because they're common parts. And there is a form of governance on Bitcoin, which is how do we pay for security? And the way Bitcoin pays for security is through money issuance. So there's inflation, which is through the block subsidy, and the block subsidies pay for the security of the system. And perhaps, hopefully, in the future, the fees are enough to pay for the security, so that's not granted. So that's one thing. But basically, the entirety of the inflation in Bitcoin goes to pay for hash power. And I think that's a bit of an extreme choice in the sense that, maybe you want to pay, maybe you want to have like 90% of your inflation budget with security, 10% of development, because development also increases security, like looking for bugs, trying, testing implementations, doing all that. That is security, and that's just as important as hashing power. I guess the reason why it's not in Bitcoin and why it's shunned, when it's shunned in other systems is that people get weird. Like the idea is that the miner by default doesn't make money. They're spending electricity as much as they're making, and if all of a sudden you're saying like, no, let's use inflation to pay people, all of a sudden immense bike shedding starts because saying like, well, are they really doing a good job? Are these people being paid? It can get political. So there is a downside to that. But I think the upside, which is being able to be current, being able to have very active and strong development, makes up for it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of Homer, and I think this concept of like loot drama has existed for since the Bronze Age and certainly before that, right? So it's sort of like, ah, I didn't get mine, like I didn't get what I deserved. And I think the most recent incarnation of that was the Chef Nomi incident on sushi. So I
Oh,
think
yeah.
there was quite a lot of heat on crypto Twitter about like his either appropriating or misappropriating the development pool
Yeah.
of it's essentially 10% allocation, right? But I mean, again, it kind of really highlights what you're describing, right? Which is that like that's a really aberrant set of rails for that, right? Which is just that he could just scoop it out whenever. That feels a little disordered.
I mean, what I find weird is not the fact that he took it, is like people outraged. Like, yeah, I mean, it was a sign. Like, what is he saying? Like, it was pretty in the open that he was assigning his token to himself. Like, oh, but there was an unspoken contract that he was not going to like sell them. Like, no, if you want the guy not to sell them, like, then don't participate or like ask for him to be on the vesting schedule or what have you. But like.
There have been a lot of these like discussions that arise whenever there's something that goes awry within these systems,
Yes.
and definitions of going awry are vary from person to person. Like, you could argue that the DAO hacker, right, was just taking advantage of a feature of the DAO's contract. And it's a spectrum. And so you find people who are very rigid, falling on one side, and people who feel more about the spirit of what they're obligated falling on another. And I think there's probably some truth in between. But it falls into pose all really quickly.
But
That was
it,
is go ahead.
it like when I think of all the people who were like yield farming sushi and were and succumbed to the greed of Chef
Yes,
Nomi,
these poor decent people.
it's just like yield farming. It's just like it's
Yeah.
it's it, it there's a big there's a lot of a pot and kettle scenario here.
Yeah.
That's a great observation, and I think it's so fascinating to watch these forces. I have a saying, it's a kind of a personal saying, which is that my sincere hope is that open source can kind of affect and purify money, because the alternative is that money will just ruin open source, right? And and it's really that kind of crazy, decentralized governance dream versus this kind of money grubbing, grabbing thing, So I think the thing that's so funny to watch, I think one of the biggest dramas on crypto Twitter was the Yam apocalypse, right? So like, all of the Yam farmers were like banded together to try to save the protocol from like imminent doom. I mean, what a story, right? But it's so funny because like it's sort of fear and greed and drama like all rolled into a burrito.
It's a classic Greek tragedy every 48 hours on crypto Twitter. It's great.
It's hard to explain what like so like so what's going on in the cryptocurrency space? So like, well, there are these people farming virtual yams.
Well, last week it was yams, this week it's sushi.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's quite bad.
But I think it's what's fair to say though that's really beautiful though. Is that like we are getting like when you talk about kind of the Bronze Age, like we are actually seeing this kind of hyper compressed, hyper accelerated kind of history of governance, you know, lesson unfolding in front of our eyes in the form of this crypto Twitter reality show, you know, because you're absolutely right. The thing is just breaking apart left and right, you know, and we're just seeing every case. It's quite interesting.
Well, what's the adage, like, you know, Bitcoin is how technologists find out about finance. There's probably a little bit of truth to that.
There is, except the thing that's so funny is that their first lessons are often from the world of gaming, right? Because, you know, and this may be a softball for you, Kathleen, but, you know, like, for example, you know, like at Consensus, I was on a boat with Vitalik, and he was talking about how everything he needed to ever learn about pump and dump, he learned auctioning Netherweave on the auction house in World of Warcraft. You know, it turns out that Vitalik is a gnome warlock. So, you know, that's it's just fun to see how much gaming there is in crypto, right? Because that's because there is economics there, right? So
I am acutely aware of that now. We talk a lot about cryptocurrencies revolutionizing traditional finance, but there are these fully digitized economies that exist and live and breathe on the web today, and you know, I think it's due time for them to be impacted by cryptocurrencies. That's why I'm interested in gaming. I think it's a much more interesting field with like fewer touch points, you know, to be disrupted by cryptocurrencies as opposed to traditional finance, which is of course ripe with a lot more complexity in some ways. And then in more subtle ways, it's like more similar. And I think, you know, a lot of the DeFi stuff looks like a game.
Yes.
And it has a lot of the similarities and arcs and narratives that you would have in a, you know, small production indie game. So it's not unfair to say the two and by comparison, just one is a bit more socially acceptable outside of the halls of cryptocurrency land.
Yeah, and I think that what we are seeing is we're seeing experimentation, and we're also seeing play, and we're also seeing kind of governance, right? And in a way, the stakes are higher, but on the flip side, like, it's really kind of a lot of experimentation and novelty. So, you know, I think that's the big stuff. So I guess, you know, tossing it back to kind of the big Tezos, like, you know, it sounds like, you know, I'm very interested in understanding, you know, what's happening with Société Générale. Like, that project seems very ambitious and, you know, amazing. So I'm curious to get your take on it, because, you know, that's CBDC central bank stuff. So I'm curious what's happening.
I mean, you should talk to Société Générale because it really is their project. So they have I may get it wrong because I don't know the details on this, but I think they have there's a company that Société Générale called Forge, which is doing some of their pilots and programs in the blockchain and digital space. And so there was this, is it an RFP or I don't know exactly, from the Banque de France and Société Générale, which is one of the major banks in France, applied to it, and they are, you know, they are using the Tezos blockchain on this.
That's exciting.
This experiment with the CBDC, but it really is their project. You know, people say like, oh, it, you know, it's Tezos thing. I mean, they're using the Tezos protocol, and my understanding is they're using the actual Tezos chain. But it's not a Tezos project. It's really a Société Générale project, and they're just using Tezos as a backend. Which is great, and that's how it should be.
Well, yeah, and you know, there are a few other success stories. You know, there's the Gendarmerie also is using some sort of time stamping function with the Tezos blockchain. So, I mean, it's not like revolutionary. It's not like the Gendarmerie runs on Tezos. You know, like, it's not any sort of press release around that. But like, it's nice to see recognition for the blockchain as being reliable enough that it passes the standards and the smell test of people who are very discerning. And I think that's one of the things that the team prides themselves on is, you know, kind of creating a culture and creating a blockchain that harkens towards such high standards for security and such high standards for architecture that, like, you know, other people would recognize it in discerning fields like institutional finance. So, you know, I appreciate that Arthur's being very, you know, modest, but it's a big deal for the people who work very diligently on you know maintaining the blockchain.
Yeah, it's serious, very serious application, obviously, and you know
very. For what it's worth, like you know, Arthur and I were at like cocktail parties in like 2013 when people would said like, no, there's never going to be a central bank digital currency on a public blockchain. Like that was crazy talk. And a lot of the enterprise blockchain space, which garnered a lot of, you know, money and investment from people, was predicated on the idea of never trusting a public blockchain because you could never possibly, you know, have such high standards. But it's funny because those people clearly never met the folks who work in private blockchain space. Anyway, that's my snide remark of the call.
But even like I remember folks from the time who were basically like built their entire public persona on basically like cheating on public blockchains. And advertising for private blockchains are now have to work with public blockchains and kind of like have to erase the tune they've been singing for the past few years. So it's very fun to watch.
Yeah. I think it's great validation for the space. And I think it's something that kept you overlooked. At the same time, like, you know, there's no person who's going to run around on email saying that, you know, France runs on Tezos or something like that, because that would just be stupid and not true. But it is a great milestone for the people who work really hard. So it's worth kind of giving a hats off to them.
My link to Société Générale is that I was in a commercial for the bank when I was 6 or 7.
You were very cute.
That's so awesome.
I can't make that up. But
I need to get a clip of that so I can roll it.
Oh, it's on the internet.
It's on the internet.
That's awesome.
I'm there for like 2 seconds. I look at a baby horse.
Okay, fantastic. So, I understand that there's like Oracle development, you know, so I'm curious about kind of DeFi on Tezos. Like, how's your perspective on that?
Well,
it's kind of like DeFi has almost jumped the shark. So initially, like if you look at DeFi, decentralized finance, I'm all for that. Like this is why you want to have smart contract on your blockchain. You want to be more than money. You want to be able to do things with that money and you want to do it in a decentralized manner. And so a lot of financial applications can be built with smart contract. But this financial application has to power real financial use cases. Some of the financial use cases that I think exist in DeFi are things like prediction market. Prediction markets serve a real purpose. Decentralized insurance serves a real purpose. Lending, borrowing, tokenization of equity. This type of things for me is decentralized finance and it's completely valuable. But a lot of the things that we see now, especially in the Ethereum ecosystem, is purely circular. It's not actually serving any financial need. It's like the only thing it's doing is it's closer to gambling in some sense, because you have all these tokens who don't really serve any purpose, but people want to trade them. And so they want to trade them with leverage. So you have borrowing and you have DEXs and so on and so forth, but it kind of like serves only one function, which is basically decentralized BitMEX. So if you think of like the DeFi ecosystem and Ethereum as like a decentralized version of BitMEX, you understand why it's successful, but you also understand why it's not necessarily like super sustainable. Or you think of it as gambling, and then you get a lot of peace of mind because it finally makes a lot more sense.
I mean, to be sure, I think like there are some efforts that like do grow the pie, and you do see like more cultural norms coming into this space. Like there's a lot more art, there's a lot more like NFTs, which I guess are, you know, akin to gaming and are trying to appeal to gaming, are becoming a part of this. So you can't toss the baby out with the bathwater. Proverbially, because it is at least more thematically broad than what we historically saw.
But like every week I see like, oh, here's this new governance token. So if you stake your governance token and provide liquidity for it, you're going to get more of this governance token, which will let people participate in different yield farming activities of different token. It will optimize the yield. And
that governance token is stupid. Like,
No, it's not. That's not my point.
Okay.
My point is that like, The stuff I've just described, I can tell that will die. That I really don't think will last for a very long time. It's kind of like FOMO 3D with extra steps. So I don't particularly believe in that. But some of the real decentralized finance application, like I mentioned, like using automated market makers, for example, for assets when you have a very long tail of assets, for example, bonding curve, auctions, insurance. A lot of these applications make sense, and I think they will persist on blockchains. but like the entire latest craze, I don't think is very want for a future.
Yeah, I mean, I think Andre Cronje said it really well, which is, you know, when he released the YFI governance token, he basically said, this has zero value, right? That was his declaration, right? Which is, I thought was an interesting cultural touch point, since it seems to have turned into this crazy rocket ship, right? And, you know, and so I think it underscores the point that you're making, which is that, you know, it's very strange, right? Because when you think about the value, you know, at least initially, I don't think people were buying it so that they could vote on improvement proposals. Like that was kind of not the mood, you know, so it definitely fit more of this kind of mood. I think the word that you used, circular, was very, I think, helpful, right? Because there is a lot of, I kind of call them like pinwheels, you know, because they're sort of just twirling, you know, like they're, you know, money spinners, right? And I think that's a very odd characteristic of the space, you know, and a lot of it is very self-referential and circular. But I think the thing that I see happening is that you were talking about kind of AMM, you were talking about insurance, you're talking about, I kind of see this as development of like organs, you know, like that these kind of large scale protocols are starting to kind of stabilize inside of this kind of primordial soup. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of like, you know, weaponized network effects and this kind of vampiric protocol attacks and things, you know, which are kind of create more spinning. But I would say that like the base layer is pretty useful, you know, in some cases.
Oh yeah, the base layer is useful. So the way I like to look at it is, imagine that you are, you know, a small country, at the blockchain. What are your experts? And your exports is like, what do you, you know, what do you sell on the outside that's kind of useful to people? And one of the things that most blockchains do is like being a store of value. So like you hold your cryptocurrency, you hold your keys, and if tomorrow the Nazis come to power and they start saying that, you know what, all your money is seized, well, no, because you can still hold your money. And that has happened, and that has happened, you know, in democracies, right, with elections. So there is a real value in that, and that is the main export of cryptocurrency, and to be honest, I think the main use case. Now, if you have something like, hey, this smart contract will let you have a safer wallet, that's useful, but that's not an export. That's an import. That's like, how do you better use the thing, and you better use it because you have this smart contract that ties in a wallet, for example. Insurance is an export. You're actually solving a real problem. Lending is an export. So a lot of these things you can think of as exports, but when I say something is circular, it's like there's no export. It's just like you basically have a governance token on DeFi DEXs, which serve you to trade other tokens from other DeFi DEXs. And that is, you know, there's no, you're not actually solving any real problem doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I have this, the way I kind of reason about it is that like energy tends to want to do stuff. You know, so it's kind of trying to find stuff to do, which is interesting. And I think kind of going back to Kathleen's point about kind of the game world, one of the things that's kind of a strange fuel for the energy is that, you know, there's kind of attention economics, right? So one of the framings that I'm kind of placing around the whole phenomenon is kind of like real money idle clicker games, right? So it's not kind of traditional casino games, but it's more like these idle clicker style, you know, because that's a lot of what the farming mentality produces.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great analogy. And like, certainly it's yeah, no, it has a lot of merit.
Yeah, it's Farmville means gambling.
Yeah, degenerate Farmville.
Yeah, but it's interesting, right? Because I would say that like the thing that ultimately, there, you know, ultimately there's some hopefulness around the idea that all of this can serve a purpose, right? Because in a sense, like if you look at the real world, right, like in some sense, the financial system ideally routes capital to need, you know, ideally, and ideally it sort of produces like, you know, goods and services through that routing of capital. I mean, that's kind of the optimal concept. So, you know, maybe we just really see the build out of the financial infrastructure without anything to kind of direct it towards.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're seeing is like a lot of experimentation and like, you know, there've been arcs and waves and valleys in the cryptocurrency space where there's different themes that take hold in narratives and memes, and sometimes they make sense and sometimes they don't. And I think we're kind of going through figuring out what DeFi is, and I think the definition of that is going to emerge a lot over the next 5 years based on what actually sticks to the wall. But right now it's a lot of spaghetti, so that's okay. But it's, yeah.
Yeah, it started out better. I think unfortunately a lot of what's happening now is going to taint the term DeFi, and so we'll have to find some other term, because people will come to associate DeFi with like virtual food.
But you know, smart contracts had to like had the hangup of, you know, there's this fictitious Oracle problem that that sort of existed in 2014 that made smart contracts a non-starter in like corporate environments, because, oh, how could you ever possibly solve the problem of an Oracle? And it was like it's supposed to be this insurmountable issue that made smart contracts, you know, virtually unusable. And like we've gotten past that, you know, just through sheer force of will, but also because it was a dumb objection in the first place. And so it's kind of like time heals all wounds in some sense, and it also kind of crowds out nonsense, you know, objections from people. And you know, there's very technical objections that can be surmounted, and there's just, you know, arcs and narrative that just simply aren't true in retrospect, you know, 5 years later. Like, who even remembers most of the objections to Ethereum? But you have to look back in the history of it and to see that like people thought that this was the most outrageous scandal of 2014, was that Ethereum would ever launch,
And
right?
people
So
still do, and it's so quaint.
it's really stupid. Yeah.
Yes,
So
and it's in bad faith, and it's frankly evil. But
well, I know there are parts of it that are evil, but there's parts of it that are just like people like just not being able to appreciate that like anything can really move forward beyond like what they did when they learned of it. But anyway, my point is like some people are going to be stuck in time, and some people are going to move with the future. Like I think the name of the game is like being a little open-minded, which, you know, if you read the Tezos position paper, is genuinely at the heart of it, is like, hey, some things are going to be good and you're going to want to fold them in, and some things are going to be bad, and oh well, like there should be a good faith way to adjudicate this. And I think the, you know, sort of epistemic vantage point there is will serve the project well.
I like the turn of phrase that you provided, which is kind of time heals all wounds. I think the corollary to that is it wounds all heals. So, you know, it's sort of the but to me, like, it's kind of related to this arc of justice, you know. Like, so the thing that's interesting is kind of the other thing I like to pull out is never bet against open source software developers, you know. In a sense, like, it's just a question of in some ways being patient, right? Because I think that's a big thing, that's a big topic, right? But I think one of the things that I think is a big cause to be hopeful about Tezos is kind of this inherent evolutionary paradigm. I don't know if you would use those words, but like, you know, I do think amendability, right? Like that I think is that to me is kind of the jewel, the crown jewel. And I think it's the treatment of it is distinct from anything else that I've seen. So I don't know if I'm missing something, but I think amendability is something that people shouldn't you know, they shouldn't ignore.
Yeah, and I think like to some extent, people still don't believe in it, in the sense that they think like, apart from some people who say no, the protocol should never change, which is almost restricted to Bitcoin today, most people think that hard fork are a great way to coordinate changes. And I don't think that what's being explained in the Tezos position paper has been completely internalized by people who think about these governance systems. But it's great in a sense, you know. It's like I don't want people to completely get it right away, because otherwise they would do it. So whenever I see people in the Ethereum community say, "Well, Vitalik explains that coin voting is plutocracy," I'm like, "Great, you go sing that."
Well, the thing that's so funny about what you're describing, though, I think you early on used the term coordination, right? But the thing that I think is really interesting becomes kind of this idea of aggregation, right? So the question becomes like, what's the inherency of the value of aggregating, right? What's the inherency of the value of having scale, right? And I think that these are really important considerations. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about money, right? Which is, you know, it's really just like any protocol, it's an agreement, right? So the number of people who agree becomes pretty relevant, right? So I think you're right. I think that, like, you know, just pure kind of, you know, anarchistic forking, you know, that's one of the things that's creating a lot of chaos in, you know, the food coin, DeFi food coins, right? Which is just this rampant vampiric forking, because it's pretty obvious that if you farm a token that has like a low cap, you know, it's going to moon, you know, relatively, you know, so it just means that we're in this kind of never ending cycle of food coins, you know, until we've exhausted every, you know, obscure food known to humankind.
I mean, it's zero sum. So it's until you've exhausted, like, you know, like other people's money.
I love the invocation of that phrase, because, you know, the thing that's interesting to me is like, who is playing kind of unbounded infinite gaming and who's playing kind of zero sum gaming, you know, and it's so interesting because you have all of the quadrants. You have people that like pretend to be playing infinite games when they're playing zero sum games, you know, and vice versa, right? Like, so you see all these kind of complex machinations of humankind all on display. But, you know, I think it's interesting.
I think it probably skews in one direction, but yes, it's an interesting time and place to be observing this. Yes.
And, you know, I'm one of the first to say, I think people tend to be way too quick to think things are zero sum. You know, if I had a penny for every time I heard like, oh, the stock market is zero sum game, finance is zero sum, cryptocurrency is zero sum. No. Oftentimes it just means that the person doesn't really understand where the value creation is happening. But it is real. For example, people don't understand that in a store of value, you have a thing called a convenience yield, and that is, you know, that is value that's being created. So it's not zero sum because you get this convenience yield. Because when the Cossacks come in your town, you get to keep your cryptocurrency. That is a value. The fruit farming, I really, apart from the entertainment value, there's really not much value creation.
You get to keep your pickles.
Yeah. But you know, if you're going to do something like this, like, they are much, much like cuter NFTs than just like one yam, you know?
Yeah. Although I shouldn't pick on pickles because, you know, pickles are actually a stabilization mechanism for so-called stable coins. So what's that?
Oh yeah. Finance, pickle finance, right? They do stabilization between stable coins, right?
Yeah. So that's not the worst one.
That sounds fine.
It's valid, right? In the context of DeFi, it's a value producer. It's a utility. Yeah, that's good. That's really good. I guess what happens next?
Ooh, what happens next?
in Tezos land. Next?
Well, the thing is, like, in Tezos, you have these constant upgrades. So I think that what happens next is that the chain keeps getting better and better. I think that there's, you know, I've written on some of the direction that I think the protocol can take.
Yeah.
You know, given some of the research has been made. So there's a test net right now that you can use for Tezos, which has private transactions, privacy preserving transactions. And it's not just for the cryptocurrency itself. It's for any token you have on Tezos, and it's very easy to deploy. So I think that's going to be interesting. There's been on some smart contract platform on some Ethereum, you've had like some approaches to do this, such as store node cache, but it's never been really like this deep integration inside the chain that makes it really easy to use. So I think this turn the privacy features are going to be interesting. There's a proposal that's currently ongoing, which essentially quadruples the speed at which you can process transactions so that we can have a more complex transaction. So it's really, you know, I don't like grand announcements or anything like that. It's really about incremental improvements, like things getting slowly better and better and better, but consistently getting better.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I think over this COVID period where I'm like quarantining, you know, I really got into this book called Atomic Habits. And the author was very into habits, right? And the thing I love about habits is that his mindset was really about that kind of 1% improvement. So he was very interested in For example, the British cycling team, because they got a coach who was only interested in finding 1% improvements. And he would just look around and he'd be like, what can we do with pedals? Or what can we do with seats, right? So he would just hunt around and look for any single thing that could be improved by like 1%, you know? And the thing that happens that's so interesting is it becomes compounding and it becomes exponential, right? And so in a sense, it feels like the evolutionary can be revolutionary, right? Like they're sort of the creature that sort of flaps his arms when he's afraid, you know, and then that creature becomes like a bird. You know, or is trying to, you know, flap its arms and get across a river, and then it starts walking across the water with little, you know. So this kind of like evolution becomes revolution type of thing is important.
If you can iterate quickly and you have a good gradient, you can go pretty far.
Yeah, that's nice. That's a very sweet mindset.
Also, Arthur is being very sympathetic to Kant, who is notoriously very rigid in his regimens, and
Yes.
who like to say dare to know, right? Which is one of Arthur's favorite adages, you know, particularly when he
It's written on my it's written on my Bastrum scale. There to know.
Yeah,
Excellent.
so.
A very outdated. It's a Kant motto. I think Kant was disturbed once from his like daily walk by the news of the French Revolution.
Ah, it's
It's very
wonderful. And you know, like to me, I'm a big fan of kind of first principles reasoning, and you know, that's really one of the reasons why I was so excited to have this conversation, because you know, you definitely have created an incredibly original solution, and I think that you know, people should be paying attention to what comes next. So I'm excited.
Thanks. It's really sweet of you. I
Thank
think that's
you.
something Arthur really prides himself on is, you know, thinking from first principles. And Lord knows he holds everyone else in the house around to it. So, yeah, no, that's the very kind words, and that's one of the compliments that I think truly makes Arthur very happy.
Awesome. Well, it's absolutely original and fundamental work. So, you know, we're excited to see more, and you know, we're obviously eagerly watching all of the great work that's being done on the platform. So, thanks so much.